The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Save big money on your outdoor project at Menards. We make landscaping simple with our free, easy-to-use design program and step-by-step project guides. Plus, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block at the best prices. Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com to see our full selection of landscape blocks and get your outdoor project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
Happy New Year! And as the latest edition of GP Racing magazine hits the newsstands, it's time for another flat chat. In the new issue of the magazine, we look at Ferrari's big push to pass a Red Bull team that's in crisis. Is Red Bull in crisis? Well, it is according to our cover, so there, it's a fact. Saturated fact. As to Adrian Newey, tech talisman exits pursued by checkbooks is how we put his departure in the magazine. A man who's hot property, even if his stated aim is to go caravanning around Europe. Famously, I don't know if this is one of those things where I say famously, and as one of my former colleagues said, only me and half a dozen other people in the universe care or know. Famously, Newey attended Repton School with Jeremy Clarkson. Equally famously, Jeremy Clarkson once described caravanning as 2 weeks of defecating in a bucket. But I digress. Time to bring on the guests. First up, someone who could probably use a caravan's entire water supply washing his hair. It's Alex Kalinorkas.
Absolutely, Codders. Although the frankly ridiculous beard that I will now be permanently possessing in the back page of GP Racing has gone, thanks to what can only be described as a catastrophic misjudgment with my beard trimmer. So it's all gone now. Enough of my ridiculous ways of looking. Thank you for having me on. And an interesting, very interesting times. Perhaps most interesting if you're Red Bull, because you're doing all the winning, but all the worrying about whether it's suddenly going to come to a grinding halt at some point.
Yeah, all their losing seems to be happening in the HR department at the moment. But we'll skip neatly on from that. Laughing like Muttley in the background at the topic of beard trimming, live from Chipping Norton, which, the internet tells me, has a caravan site where prices start at a mere £6.70 a day. I presume that's the winter rate. It's Mark Gallagher.
Yes, and of course it's also where Jeremy Clarkson lives. He's just up the road from my house, actually. So really good to be on here and talking about all things Newey and Red Bull, which, you know, 1st of January this year, we didn't expect we'd be talking about this story before the quarter of the season was over, and here we are. So it's an extraordinary development. Looking forward to chatting to you about it.
Yeah, and of course Ferrari heavily tipped to be courting Adrian Newey, and we were wondering, you know, as we closed the magazine for press last week, whether, you know, one of those things might happen where an announcement is made in between us clicking Apple P for it to rattle off the printers and go in the envelopes to subscribers and boxes to WH Smiths, etc. And it actually arriving on the shelves. And thankfully that didn't happen. So maybe he is going caravanning. Who knows? Or motorhoming. I believe he's more interested in taking a fun bus that's ambulatory, probably with a smart car on the back. I'm digressing again. I wonder if he has an e-bike or a proper bicycle on the back. No, I'm digressing again. Anyway, this month, Andrew Benson weighs up the factors that have fed into Ferrari becoming one of the leading challengers to Red Bull once again. And perhaps more significantly, he ponders what might come next. At the time of writing, we knew a big upgrade package was coming, but not when. Now we know it's going on the car at Imola this weekend. We're recording this just before that kicks off. And then, you know, the big question really here is whether it will provide a performance uptick or not. And we've seen in previous years with Ferrari that this isn't necessarily a given. And meanwhile, as evinced in a very busy Miami weekend for Alex, McLaren seemed to be able to unlock performance in their car with pretty much every upgrade. So Alex, you know, Andrew talks to Fred Vasseur, and Johnny Noble's also talked to Fred Vasseur about the evolution of the team and of how having a better car makes it easy to look smarter on strategy. But also there's this business of making the team more comfortable with existing on the edge and taking more risks. I mean, is that really the foundation of what we're seeing at the moment?
I think so. I think I would say it's more to do with the decisions that were made sort of a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago now, when Fred Vasseur sort of first arrived, realised just what the scale of the challenge was, as Andrew points out in his excellent feature. And yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, I think quite rightly lambast Ferrari for their terrible communications efforts. But you can sort of see a little bit of method in the madness now, in the terms of, like, there was very little said about what needed to be changed, particularly on the car front in the early stages of 2023, when it was clear the Ferrari was not a title challenger as it had been the previous year in 2022. So, you know, essentially Ferrari were like, no, we don't need to change concept. We don't need to do anything. And then suddenly you get to the Spanish Grand Prix, the concept on the upper aero surfaces at least has changed. But, you know, I think we're really seeing now that it's always been the case that if you wanted to make change to a Formula One team, you had to wait a long time. With the cost cap, it's just baked in now. So the decisions that are being made a year ago are what's really coming through. And as we'll go on to talk about later about Mercedes, that's alarmingly still not paying off in the case of that team. So yeah, it's you know, it's credit to what Vasseur has done. But I think the key thing is actually what Carlos Sainz talks about and what you alluded to, Codders, in about how the car treats its tyres. It simply means the drivers aren't all over the place when it comes to heating up the tyres. That means they can not only do their races faster, they can stay closer to Red Bull, but also it gives Ferrari strategic variance. And I think that's playing out. But yeah, credit to Ferrari for making a big step over the winter. But this upgrade is comprehensive. It's 8 key bits of the car that have changed. And, you know, that's what I saw in Miami with McLaren. You know, you go down in the pit lane, they do their car presentation moments sort of an hour before FP1. Maybe it's for an hour, a short time before FP1 at every race. It's mandatory in the rules that the cars are on display. And the media get to have a look. If you're lucky enough to get in the pit lane, you can go and have a look. And what I saw from that McLaren was it just looked, I mean, this is not in-depth technical analysis, I'm afraid, but it just looked comprehensive. It looked detailed at every level. And then walking down to the Mercedes, I'm like, oh, hang on a minute, that's got an upgrade on it, but it just doesn't look very complex. Having said that, the Ferrari's never looked very complex, and it's always been rapidly fast. So yeah, McLaren obviously making a big step. Now the pressure's on Ferrari, but with those 8 changes, it does seem to be as comprehensive as what McLaren were able to do. But will it work? Because as you say, McLaren's very successfully, very impressively had that pedigree of saying, right, we know what we're going to do, we know when we're going to do it, and it's going to work. And it has worked. Can Ferrari do that? Unclear.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting what you just said there, Alex, because I was talking to someone the other day about the McLaren upgrades and, you know, how they worked last year and how they're working this year. And then you turn to Ferrari and you know, we all know that once a team gets a process going that works in terms of upgrades that genuinely deliver performance, and there's an inherent confidence in the team and its ability to do that, it also then has, you know, the knock-on effect. You know, the drivers are being told there's something coming, and then when they're given it, actually, you know what, it translates into lap time. And, you know, it was really interesting reading this feature because, you know, you take something like this shift within Ferrari towards a car that, as Andrew says, is more benign, you know, to drive, and it just doesn't have these slightly evil characteristics. And as you say, it also then has a knock-on effect of opening up strategy and opportunities, which makes the team look so much more composed because they have a car that actually is able to deliver for them over, you know, a longer period of time during a race on individual stints. Taking a step back from the whole thing and just looking at Vasseur and how he comes across in the feature, it is remarkable, you know, when I think about how, you know, he came up through the junior formula, running his own organization, then, you know, making the transition into Formula One, and then ending up with the top job at Sauber. The guy brings with him so much gravitas and inherent management capability. He knows what he's doing, and he's able to lead, you know, lead in the broadest sense, you know, motivate people, inspire people to become aligned, you know, to say, right, what are the issues? How are we going to problem solve them? I mean, this is something that I know we're going to talk about Mercedes in a moment, but, you know, James Allison, I remember doing a piece with him and him talking to me about the importance of a winning team in just refining a process that everyone then has confidence over in terms of what it's doing and what it's going to deliver. And of course, the opposite of that is when you're going to keep getting lost, which ironically is where kind of Mercedes seem to be at the moment. So you can lose that, but if you can build it, you know, if you can build that composure and that confidence into, you know, what you're bringing to the table in terms of car performance, and the drivers can then take that and go with it, it has this just upward trajectory that becomes, you know, so ultimately so positive and builds momentum. We're seeing it with McLaren, and I think we're seeing it at Ferrari too, and it'll be really interesting to see how this latest upgrade goes when we see it on track.
It's also interesting for me that McLaren recruited David Sanchez, very high profile headhunting from Ferrari, and of course he then had to observe a year of gardening leave before he got his feet under the table in Woking, by which point they'd concluded that they didn't really need him, it appears.
I just jump in. I think he walked in there and reading between the lines of what Andrea Stella was saying, where he, in his very charming way, goes, oh, he was too senior. He was too, you know, he sort of basically go, oh, he was overqualified. I think reading between the lines, I think he walked in, realised he wasn't going to be the top Adrian Newey style technical director, you know, in the sort of traditional but powerful sense. And because of that very complicated structure McLaren implemented after they had agreed to sign him, I think they both just went, hang on a minute, this isn't what he was like, this is what I didn't sign up for. And McLaren was like, well, this is what it is. And they were like, if you don't like it, that's it, you can go. And to be fair, they didn't stand in his way. He's very quickly arrived at Alpine. So yeah, my reading of the situation is that it's more about him than the team, if that makes sense.
You can take it or leave it, but you'd better believe it, as I believe Heaven 17 sang in their biggest hit. So it's certainly very interesting that he's moved straight into a very senior job at Alpine, which is probably the kind of position he'd been coveting. But would, you know, when Otmar Szafnauer had his little media lunch touting his new app a few weeks ago, and he was talking about various things to do with matters arising in Formula One, and of course everyone was asking about what a basically slow motion car crash Alpine was, and he was trying to be diplomatic about it, I pitched in a question saying, how hard is it when you're at the head of an organisation that is perceived to be struggling to recruit people who are ambitious and want results? Because, you know, you can get people, you can throw money at people, but if you're perceived as a losing team, you're not really going to get the cream of the crop. And, you know, Mark, you've grilled senior and competitive people on stage many a time and had them at conferences, and they've spoken to business people about the winning mentality. I mean, what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. It's funny you mentioned this thing about recruitment and talent and, you know, again, getting momentum into an organization with the people who are joining it. It was something I was talking about at an event yesterday. And, you know, the question I was given by someone is, how do the top teams recruit and retain, you know, talent? And of course, it's such an important topic. And, you know, one of the things about, you know, you mentioned Alpine and Sanchez there. I mean, when you look at the wider Formula One story at the moment, you know, we started off the podcast talking about Adrian Newey. You know, we're yet to see the knock-on effect of his departure from Red Bull, because you can very quickly get a brain drain. So it can work in both directions. You can lose a couple of key people who then bring their lieutenants with them, or their lieutenants kind of lose faith in, you know, what's happening within the organization, particularly if those lieutenants are not then promoted into the top job. So, you know, when people, when the boss moves on, very often there are younger people who in the organization who think, or people who haven't had the opportunity to do the top job, who really yearn to be given that opportunity. When the leadership then go and recruit someone from outside to replace whoever it is that's just left, you know, that can have a demoralizing effect on people. And this is why it's so important that in an ideal world, any competitive organization, and certainly in Formula One, if you can keep the talent within the pool that you already have, if you can promote from within, it is ultimately ideal. And I mean, again, got to mention James Allison again. Something that he often talks about is, you know, when you bring people into a Formula One team at a young age, load them up with responsibilities, test them, see how good they are, bring them on, give them opportunity, because hopefully you're actually giving the next set of leaders the opportunity to, you know, develop within the team. So whenever we see all the chopping and changing that you and I have, you know, we've talked about so many times over the years on the podcast, you know, when we see what's happening, notably in uncompetitive teams, you know, teams that are struggling, you see all this chopping and changing, people coming and going, and lots of kind of thrashing around. What they're trying to do is to find that stable leadership platform that's going to take them forward. And yet we all know, when we look at Red Bull over the last 20 years, Mercedes over the last, you know, 15 years, stability is all important. And if you can get stability in your talent pool and your skill set, it really does pay dividends in the long run. And, you know, this is why Alpine has been such a basket case in recent times.
From that perspective, what do we make of Charles Leclerc swapping his engineer, Alex? You know, you've been at Miami, you've seen their very nice new paint job that had far less blue in it than we expected. And once again, Ferrari communicating weirdly, as you alluded to earlier. And we get this, what's curiously phrased missive that Charles Leclerc's engineer is going to get involved in other company programs. So, you know, the internet wailed as we kiss goodbye to the "we are checking" meme. What else do you think is at play behind this?
Well, I can offer a little bit of insight into why that comms was so typically Ferrari. It basically, my understanding is they haven't actually yet defined what his role is going to be post being Charles Leclerc's race engineer. So it's almost like the Toto Wolff way of being fired, to put it crudely. We're gonna promote someone is how you frame it, and then you decide what to do with them later on. That's what I understand is happening with Xavi Marcos. It's just not been defined what program he's gonna be doing for Ferrari. So also just very quickly going back to the point about you know, struggling organizations attract, you know, the issue they have with attracting top talent. Well, I think this is credit to Fred Vasseur. You know, Ferrari, it was reputation when he joined at the end of 2022, start of 2023, was pretty appalling, really, when you consider how badly things had gone with that championship going off the boil. So the fact that he's been able to sign, you know, Loic Serra, Jerome D'Ambrosio coming this year, Serra was already joining midway through 2023, and they've come from Mercedes. Obviously, Lewis Hamilton has come from Mercedes, so credit to him. But yeah, the specifics of the Leclerc engineer change, I think for me, this all, he'll talk about it, I'm sure, at Imola this weekend, or if he's not asked about it, someone's not doing their job in the media, but there we go. I think it comes from the recent struggles he's been having. And equally, when things have been going well, the communication between him and Marcos was just all over the place. He got pole at Austin last year, and Marcos says time deleted, and Leclerc loses his mind immediately because he thinks it's his time that's been lost. But actually, Marcos is saying time deleted for Verstappen, and he's like, say the name first. So they're falling out even when things are going right. And there was this bizarre situation in China where Marcos is going, try your original line at turn 7 and 8 on, like, we're like 2 laps to go, and Leclerc's like, what do you mean? What, look, horizontal? What are you talking about? No, original line. I don't understand. And then Marcos just goes, we sort of slightly exasperatedly, just forget it, it's the last lap. And it's sort of, you know, it's little things like that that we seize on and the internet seizes on and perhaps overdo it. But I think it does reflect the fact that the comms just was an issue there, that things so many times hadn't gone right. And then this year, obviously Leclerc, the chosen young star to carry on and not Carlos Sainz when Lewis Hamilton comes, has been the second driver, really, in terms of results, although he was very good in Miami despite his FP1 off. And you know, these little things, changing engineer is obviously hoping to address that, but I think it comes with risk. And I wrote that in my column for Autosport magazine and autosport.com plus this week. There's risk to that. Like, Cod is actually, the credit should go to GP Racing and me, obviously, because it was a feature.
Of course.
I wrote for you in 2020, talking about what, you know, the value and the intricate and important and intrinsic nature of a driver race engineer relationship. Because 4 years ago, it was Alex Albon, now in a whole different career as Williams' long-term future. He was having his race engineer changed at Red Bull. You know, they were getting Simon Rennie back from a factory role. They were, you know, getting demoting or sort of swapping the engineer that they'd put in to please Daniel Ricciardo before he jumped off to Renault in 2019. And that was sort of a big, like, hang on a minute, this is that teams don't normally do this. I spoke to Roddy Basso, obviously we know Ferrari very well. He was Rubens Barrichello's engineer there. Then went on to Red Bull, doing other things now involving electric power boats. And he said to me, look, you can only do this once or twice. You can only change your engineer once or twice, because if the performance doesn't uptick when the team have very publicly backed you, because like if Mercedes was to suddenly get rid of Pete Bonington, everyone's going to ask questions. What on earth is going on? So it's quite a dramatic thing Ferrari have done, or a drastic thing is perhaps a better way of phrasing it. And it's got to work for Leclerc, because he can't just say, oh, I need another engineer. Or it's a bit like Ricciardo and the RB chassis. You can't just go every time you're off the pace, oh, the chassis, something's wrong with the chassis. It's almost like a boy who cried wolf scenario. So yeah, it's certainly very interesting, but not without risk for Leclerc.
Yeah, this is such an important topic, isn't it? Because we all, you know, we talk about the upgrades and the technology and, you know, of course, the cars and what goes into making them quick and consistent is something that we spend an inordinate amount of time about. And yet the human factor is so critical. I mean, in my view, it's the most critical thing is the driver race engineer relationship, how they communicate, how they trust and respect each other. They almost have to have a, you know, it's a, dare I say it, it's a sporting marriage. You know, you're kind of one with the other. It's a, you know, I've seen over the years engineers and drivers develop, you know, almost a level of telepathy. You know, they understand each other so well. The driver knows and trusts in the engineer that the engineer says we need to do X, Y, Z with the car or with the strategy. The driver believes in it, you know, believes in that. And says, oh, right, okay, we'll crack on with it, you know. And equally the other way around, you know, if the driver saying to the engineer, well, this is all very well, but this is what I'm feeling in the car. You know, this is what I'm feeling in the seat of my pants when I'm driving it. And so the examples you just give of those communications errors, you know, that is really symptomatic of, you know, a relationship that's just misfiring. And at this level, you can't afford to have that. I've always been a believer that, you know, that there are people still, I think, you know, within the industry who believe that both sometimes drivers and definitely engineers can be unscrewed like light bulbs and just replace, you know, take one out, put another one in. That is completely, you know, we know it's wrong with the drivers and for sure it's wrong with race engineers. And to your point, Alex, it's such a massive change that if you get, you really can't do it a couple of times. You can maybe do it once. And if you do it once, I mean, to take a sort of leaf out of Total Wolf's management book, when a relationship doesn't work, you can't blame either party. You actually have to blame the organization and say, we got that wrong. You know, we got that wrong. But the fact that we have had to make a change means that we made the wrong decision at the beginning. So we tried pairing people and that pairing hasn't worked. So the new pairing absolutely has to work. And I'm I mean, we all know how quick and impressive Charles Leclerc is. I'm slightly on the side of having a big concern about Charles and his overall career trajectory. You know, where is it going? Is he ever really going to get on top of this? You know, it's a bit like, you know, with Alpine. I've had a belief that Renault and Alpine have been, you know, just permanently in transition. As long as I've ever known them within Formula One, they're just constantly in transition. And you sort of think, you know, is Charles always going to be constantly the nearly man? You know, the guy who can produce just stunning performances, but where's the consistency? Where's the belief? Where's the the momentum? So something like this, again, it's nothing other than, you'd have to say it's nothing other than a blow. You wouldn't want to come into a Formula One season at Ferrari with their lead driver and change race engineer after a quarter of the season. So let's see what happens with this next chapter. I do rather fear it just might be the latest in the, you know, Charles Leclerc nearly getting there saga.
Well, we'll see. It's interesting, isn't it? I always view broadcast conflict between driver and engineer as a slightly unreliable barometer of the relationship, because naturally the TV people want drama. So if a driver and engineer are just sort of the only thing that gets fraught is the discussion of where they're going to go for dinner afterwards, that's not going to be broadcast. Equally, if it's sweetness and light between them, not going to be broadcast. When they're bickering like an old married couple, yes, that's going to be broadcast. So there's a statistical skew in that direction. I suppose we should move on. We did mention we'd speak about Mercedes, and yeah, elsewhere in the new issue of GP Racing, we look at something that's happening all over again. Not the Lonnie Gordon song, which reached number 14 in Sweden in 1990, allegedly originally written for Donna Summer, but I digress again. No, this thing that's happening all over again, Mercedes designing a stinker. No phased arpeggios have been involved in Lewis Hamilton having his worst start to a season since 2009. And even then, if we look back, McLaren silk persificated that car into a winner by season's end. Really, that looks like a tall order for Mercedes, especially given the budget cap and the difficulty they seem to be having getting to grips with the modern ground effect era. So what's gone wrong again? Alex, you wrote the feature. You've got your finger right on what's gone wrong.
Well, yes, I actually wanted to start this section by making 2 points, one which paints me in a terrible light, and one which hopefully is just me bringing some
paint
different
away.
Insight to the podcast. Essentially, I kind of forgot I wrote this. just because of the nature of the monthly magazine, the long lead times we have with the production and everything, it's been a few weeks since I was at my laptop and getting it all done for you, Codders. And so I was refreshing myself, and I thought, wow, my goodness, actually, it's full of brilliant insight, and of course it is. But I think it helps to illustrate the point. And the other point I'm just going to make is, obviously, you know, in my day job at Autosport for our Grand Prix, as their Grand Prix editor, we wrote a cover feature about Mercedes, which was basically, it's gone wrong again. It's like this one, but it was basically the magazine was at the exact same point following the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix as it was in 2023 and 2022, and it just shows you this is happening literally in exactly the same way, although of course not figuratively. Actually, is the word I'm searching for, again and again. And the newsstand sales were down. Like, I did, and I think those 2 points, the fact that I was like, oh yeah, Mercedes, and the readers are like, oh yeah, Mercedes, it's almost like, to a certain extent, and obviously this is crudely put, who cares? Like, they've gone from being this steamrolling brilliant team to just, oh, it's Mercedes, oh okay, yeah, that was cool, what George Russell did in qualifying, brilliant overtaking from Lewis Hamilton in the race, but we don't expect anything of them now. And I would say that's probably way more damning than anything else. But yeah, it has gone wrong again. The main sort of body of the feature makes the point that at every round, from Bahrain to Saudi Arabia to Australia, but the main body of the feature makes the point that from every round at the start of the season, from Bahrain to Saudi Arabia to Australia and to Japan, Mercedes was offering a different excuse every time. And that's really alarming, because it shows that they don't really understand what's going wrong. But they're saying that, again, we're seeing these theoretical numbers. We're actually measuring way more downforce at Suzuka at certain corners, but it's not there in lap time. And it's really worrying that they can't understand that. And the thinking now is more that, yeah, they've got the sort of aerodynamics right, but it's not working well with the mechanical ride of the car. And again, we've been saying this for years now. This is what Adrian Newey and Red Bull understood immediately with these new regulations. So again, it's going back to what I said about Ferrari. They can't spend their way out of trouble now. They're locked into this. And, you know, I start the piece by saying, did Lewis Hamilton look at this car from what he was seeing in the wind tunnel? We know the drivers drive the early versions of the next year's car very late. So late in 2023, he would have driven it on the simulator. Did he see that and think, right, actually, do you know what? I'm going to give Fred Vasseur a call and just say, look, I've got this contract that means I can get out for 2025. We don't know that. Lewis has done a very good job of not publicly slating Mercedes in the press, on TV. I do think his true feelings come out when he's on his team radio. We talk about that engineer relationship. There's no holding back when he's not happy, when he's like, that's it, that's all I got. There's nothing more in this car. A tricky time for Mercedes, and as is also in the piece, we talk about they've released their financial results. Well, a key part of that was we measured the fact that we were down in terms of our TV coverage in 2023, I think it would have been, because we weren't on the podium as much. Well, at the time of recording, they've not been on the podium once. So if anything, it seems to be getting worse for Mercedes.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating development, because you consider all those years we went through of Mercedes dominance, and we were all, well, generally kind of whinging and complaining about Mercedes' dominance in F1, even though they did have a couple of decent fights in the championship along the way. But then it's all fallen apart. And again, an interesting thought is that, when you go back to 2022, major regulation changes, you say Adrian and Red Bull got so much of that right and Mercedes got so much of it wrong. And, one has to then go back to 2021, while Mercedes were still winning and they were conceiving the 2022 car. And I know that one of Toto Wolff's biggest fears, and that one of the team's biggest fears through those dominant years, was that they would ever become complacent. They were terrified of complacency, because when you're so dominant and things are going so well, can you kind of metaphorically take your foot off the gas pedal and sort of back off, and then all of a sudden you get blown away by the competition again. I have a feeling that in the fullness of time we'll get to hear what has happened, because James Allison and Toto are very smart guys. They've got very clever people working with them. One has to say it looked to me quite a lot like their fear of complacency led them down a road of, let's really innovate. Let's take a big step forward. Let's do something radical. So they come out with this side zero side pod concept in 2022, and it sets tongues wagging. Everyone's going, my goodness, if that works, they're just going to be, disappearing off into the distance. Then you find out that doesn't work, and the porpoising was such a major issue at the beginning as well. And you find out that actually someone like Adrian Newey is looking at that and thinking, oh, actually, that's a really interesting concept, but it needs a little bit of development. And then Adrian proceeds to take a couple of years to take that idea and then iterate it and deploy it this season with such good effect. So Mercedes, to me, seem to have had two issues. One is that perhaps that fear of complacency led them to over-innovate, to overextend themselves in 2022, and that's had huge knock-on effects. And then the second thing is this whole issue of measurement and what's working in the virtual environment and what's working with your digital tools and your design phase and your development phase, and working with your digital twin in terms of the vehicle isn't translating onto the racetrack. And that's hugely problematic, because it's so complex, and it means that you have decisions being made on the basis of essentially bad data. And if the data is bad and you can't identify where that's coming from, I mean, you'll be nowhere until that is solved. And exactly to your point, Alex, when you I was reading the preview to the Emilia Romagna Grand Prix with Toto, and he was, you know, talking about issues with the car, and, you know, they're hoping to improve, and everybody's working hard. And I was reflecting it and thinking, there isn't really a confident narrative around all of this. They're not giving the impression of really being on top of it at all. And again, it won't be for lack of trying. So I suspect that at the risk of, you know, we all know a bad workman blames their tools. We know the Mercedes team, they're not full of bad workmen and women. They are full of super talented people earnestly trying to make their way back to the front of the grid. I think that within their toolbox, there's something that's not quite delivering for them, and you end up with this mismatch. And I mean, ultimately, you know, we all in sport hear about the benefit of marginal gains. You know, if you do 101 things just a little bit better, you end up with competitive advantage. The inverse is also true. If you have marginal errors, if you have lots of little small things, they can add up to becoming your competitive disadvantage. And that seems to be where Mercedes are at the moment. And it is really a remarkable story, because perhaps for all kinds of reasons, this was one team we didn't expect to lose their way just so dramatically as they have done.
Yeah, it's funny we've come back to Adrian Newey again and mentioning how he's prospered very often when the rules change. I mean, apart from 1994 being possibly an outlier. And here we have, just in the past couple of weeks, Christian Horner quoted by, I think he spoke to Sky Sports, saying that Adrian doesn't like rule changes. Now, what do we think of that? Well, I can see on my little screen here, Alex shaking his head. Is this a case of, you know, it is well known that one of the reasons that Newey is highly disgruntled with Red Bull at the moment and leaving is not just the whole what Christian Horner is alleged to have done with a female employee, but also the fact that over the past 18 months or so, pretty much every interview Christian's done in which Adrian's name has come up, he's sought to downplay Adrian's input into the car. There's been talk of him only working 2 days a week and saying, you know, the other tech team, Pierre Vacher, etc., have much more influence over the car than Adrian. And Newey apparently has been privately fuming. We heard tell last year that he'd sent a multi-page email to Christian Horner documenting every single part of the car that he'd had input on. And so do we think that now Adrian has finally handed in his notice, Christian's thinking, well, you know, I can just slag him off when I want and say, you know, we don't really need him anymore. He does this, he does that. He doesn't like rule changes and whatever. And Newey just has to sit there on the pit wall or fiddle with this new billionaire's toy and see out his contractual period.
Well, we know it very well at Motorsport Network that Adrian Newey was unhappy with what Christian Horner was saying, because every time there was one of those stories went up, we got an earful basically from Red Bull. We've been getting it, Red Bull's communications guys, we've been getting it from Newey. But yeah, it's more, you know, it's more just I think that reflects the potentially the long term breakdown in their relationship. But the idea that Adrian Newey doesn't like rule changes, I mean, honestly, you could only assume that is Horner sticking the knife in and just, you know, trying to sow chaos or something. Because I actually asked Newey that in Mexico last year. We had a sit down interview and I spoke about these changes of rules eras. And the question pretty much was, do you enjoy them? And the answer was yes. And here's why. Because, you know, that just speaks to the nature of his character. He likes sitting down, looking through the rules and seeing what's possible, where you can get those key competitive advantages. And I think what's really interesting is that he said about this current rule set, when he initially read it, he was like, that doesn't sound good, because it was so restrictive. And then right at the last minute, with some lobbying, presumably from Adrian Newey, he says some other teams as well, the FIA and F1 open up the rules again, and that sort of allowed for one team to run away and dominate. So it's classic Formula One. It's his own worst enemy, but there we go. But yeah, I think, you know, we know the relationship with Newey and Red Bull is ending, and that is for another team to game. I don't believe for a second that he's genuinely gonna. Maybe for a little while he will go and enjoy you know, traveling around in his caravan or whatever. Oh, also, by the way, I was aware of the Clarkson Newey school history. So if that must be really widely known, if I know something in popular culture, but there we are. So Horn has got a lot going on, let's put it that way. And this just seems to me, yeah, another element of that. But where Newey will end up, I don't know. I thought it was quite revealing, the chat he had with Martin Brundle, where, yeah, he insisted he wasn't going anywhere else. And there was this sort of awkward laughter about, well, you look good in red. That spoke quite a lot, but did handle that quite well, nevertheless. I think everybody in F1 would like to see, well, obviously not people at Red Bull or whatever, would like to see Newey go to Ferrari. It's the sort of thing you can imagine back in the day Bernie Eccleston would have insisted somehow would happen. But also, I think, you know, this again, it comes back to Red Bull. The cracks are appearing. Or whatever. Do you want another cliche? The empire is beginning to fall. Like, these are the early signs, the early stages of something like that really happening.
Yeah, they've not quite crossed the Rubicon yet.
Yeah, Nero fiddles while Rome burns, eh? So it's an interesting one, because my former boss, Mr. Jordan, of course, has ended up being involved in all of the negotiations for Adrian Newey's departure from Red Bull. A slightly unexpected twist to the story. Of course, they're really good buddies. They live beside each other in Cape Town, where Eddie and Adrian spend part of the year. And then they have this shared passion for sailing. And Eddie has introduced Adrian to Oyster Yachts, which are built in Southampton. And Adrian's commissioned his own Oyster 885 yacht to be built. There's a very nice YouTube video if you want to go and watch that. And I think that's what he'll do. I think he'll disappear off and do a bit of sailing for a while. But I think it'll be a break. I don't think it'll be anything. It won't be a sabbatical from the sport. It'll just be he'll go and have a nice extended break. That yacht that he has commissioned is almost completed. Actually, a friend of mine was on it yesterday down at the Oyster Yacht Space and sent me a very nice photograph of it. So it still needs to have the mast and rigging and stuff put on it, but it's getting there. And then last Saturday at the Monaco Historic Weekend, Eddie Jordan interviewed Adrian on stage at the Monte Carlo Yacht Club, all about his sailing and his hopes for the future and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's pretty clear that the end of this Red Bull chapter is speeding towards Adrian. I mean, yes, he's going to hang around until the end of first quarter of next year working on the hypercar, but I don't expect he'll spend an inordinate amount of time at Milton Keynes. He'll be doing quite a lot of remote work, and he might end up doing quite a lot of remote working from marinas in Europe if he gets his boat in the water. It's what's then going to be fascinating is what happens next, and because we all know that with the regulation change coming up, Adrian's input to whichever team lands him, it could be critical, because he brings with him not only his skill and knowledge and his genius in terms of being able to read the regulations for what they do say and also for what they don't say. He also brings with him that 20 years of experience of helping Red Bull Racing to be one of the dominant teams of all time. And, you know, throw all of that together, who wouldn't want to have him in the mix? And frankly, does anyone even need him full time? You know, you could imagine Adrian landing a very nice consultancy with someone where he's, you know, closely advising a design team, perhaps not necessarily taking on a technical directorship role at his stage in life. But, you know, who knows? He loves the sport. He's passionate about it. He loves winning. And boy, do I think he will feel that he has another opportunity to prove just how good he is in the wake of the way the relationship with Christian and Red Bull has come to an end. He'll want to show the world that, yes, he is the man who can really make the difference.
It's funny, isn't it? The 2026 rules are still not quite defined. And yet this week we've had Stefano Domenicali, the head of Formula One, talk about the next set after that, 2030. And what was interesting to me is that he highlighted two of the big issues surrounding the cars today, which are weight, which blunts performance, and noise, which many fans think there isn't enough of. And many people read between the lines. What he said was quite vague and equivocal when you look at it, you look back at it. In the room, people were thinking that this is a signal that normally aspirated V8s might be coming back as to just to pluck an engine format out of the ether. And that's chiefly because hybrids are a major contributor to weight. And there's an argument that sustainable fuels could remove some of the perceived obstacles against a return to, I'm going to do the little thing with my fingers, proper racing engines. You know, what do you think about that, Alex? Are we right to sort of cherish or cling on, you know, a little bit like Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet in Titanic and the floating door? Are we clinging on to the wreckage? Do we want V8s back?
I always, because people often complain about that scene as if, like, why didn't she just pull him up? But it's like they just don't understand Archimedes. Like, I mean, obviously it's a film and it's not real, but like two people on one door, that door's sinking, obviously. Anyway.
Physics.
Exactly. It's interesting. I think actually there was a key word in your question to me there, Codders. Is it right to do this? Or, you know, is it the sort of what's right about it? And actually, I think a lot of this chat, I think we've got to consider real long-term consequences, not just for Formula One, but for the world. Because in the short term, and this is an argument I completely buy, I think it's really logical. I think Karun Chandhok, former F1 racer, very distinguished TV pundit now, has made this argument very eloquently that, yeah, if sustainable fuels really do work out, put them in V8 engines, you get lighter cars, you get better sounds, hopefully you get better racing if it works with all the aerodynamics, because again, that problem isn't going away. I totally buy that argument. And actually, I think it really does make a lot of sense. But we know the climate problem, until something really seismic comes along and changes that, isn't going to go away. And so I think it still leaves F1 with a massive image problem if it abandons the hybrids. Like, again, I'd love to see lighter cars that are just as safe and strong, and we don't have a safety problem like we used to, that are more agile, the drivers like it, and it creates a better product. I do like that. But I just worry about the image problem of ditching the hybrids. Like, in my past life, someone actually, you know, was asking me about my job and jumped in and was sort of like, I can't believe they're still using internal combustion engines in Formula One. That's outrageous. And I was sort of like, well, hang on a minute, I'm not F1's PR here. I don't have to defend them. But just so you know, they are actually, you know, plug-in hybrids. And they're like, oh, okay, actually, that does make quite a considerable difference. And I just think that, you know, if things really do start going wrong with the climate, things like Formula One are going to have a lot of explaining to do. And yes, it's just something, I just think it's something to consider when you then add in that it's not just going to be F1's decision, like as in F1 alone, Stefano Domenicali, what he said, it sounds more like he was offering at this stage his personal wish list. That could come to fruition very easily. That's going against my exact point. That could come to fruition very logically. But the FIA's got to sign up to this as well. And they're going to be having all sorts of lobbying saying, hang on a minute, this isn't what you want to do if you want to be serious about being a positive influence on the climate crisis. So, yeah, is it right to do it in one way from a pure enjoyment point of view? Yeah, I think it is right to do it if the sustainable fuels work, and that's doing a lot of heavy lifting. But the wider question of is it right, that's something I really do wonder about.
I'll pick up off the back of that and say that I remember coming back from an FIA technical working group meeting in Paris in 2010 and presenting the engineers at Cosworth with what the plan for the new era would be, the 2014 hybrid engine era. And very eloquently, one of our senior engine designers, a very, very smart guy, he just leant across the table, looked at the sort of summary of the proposed hybrid rules and said, you do realize these are going to sound and I said, yeah, we do know that. And he said, so why are they doing it? And I said, well, they're doing it because, you know, the FIA have this view, you know, Jean Todt has this view that energy efficiency should be one of his legacies. You know, Formula E is going to come along and then he's going to do the hybridization in Formula One. And the engineers sitting in the meeting, you know, all of them super interested in efficiency and all of that, they all said, yeah, but what about the sound of our sport? And here we are 14 years later, the three of us talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, Stefano Domenicali might be opening the door to a return to a better sounding Formula One. And it's kind of one of those things where, you know, it comes along, it happened. It was a technical decision by a bunch of technical people at technical meetings in Paris, not talking about the sport's heritage or sound or marketing or fan appeal or any of those other sort of fuzzy stuff that don't get talked about in technical working groups. And it got forced into the sport. Now, where we are now, I agree with you, Alex. The synthetic fuel opportunity is a formidable one. It's actually a formidable one for Formula One, and it's a formidable opportunity for the world because it's potentially the future for aviation, the future for shipping. It's a future for the classic car and the classic racing sector because it means that we don't need to take fossil fuels out of the ground. And that's a really big step forward. There's a number of other apps. So yes, you could run a V6. You could have a high revving V6 engine. You could take the existing engine and get rid of the fuel flow, and you could start putting the revs up. You could run a V8, you could run a V10, you could do whatever you wanted, because with those synthetic fuels, it's a drop-in fuel that will run in any internal combustion engine, and it could sound amazing, absolutely amazing. And I think they should return to high-revving internal combustion engines with synthetic fuels. But to your exact point, Alex, I don't think we can undo the hybridization. The thing that we could do is we could reduce the hybridization. We could look at perhaps potentially smaller batteries and smaller energy stores. I think the abandonment of that would be a massive decision, because you then have to think about the car manufacturers investing in Formula One and the message that they're trying to put out. There's also, interestingly, the message that so many of the energy companies involved in Formula One, you know, you think about Aramco and ExxonMobil and Shell and BP and Petronas, and actually they're super in favor of Formula One having an energy efficient formula, and they like to promote that. So you have a substantial amount of sponsorship involved. You have a substantial amount of investment from the car manufacturers, all hinging on Formula One representing something that has a degree of road relevancy. I've always believed for many, many, many years, you know, Formula One's road relevancy is almost irrelevant. You know, it's road irrelevancy in many respects. However, it's important that the sport does the right thing, as well as being seen to do the right thing. And again, I agree with you, Alex. You know, the climate issue isn't going to go away. It's going to get worse. The profound impact of climate change is already with us. We see that all over the world. Lots of issues and around that. So this is a huge issue. So there is a very easy solution for Formula One. We can have our cake and eat it. We could have a high revving internal combustion engine running on synthetic fuel and marry that with a hybrid system. And you have the best of both worlds. And I suspect that's more likely to be what might happen come 2030.
Indeed. Well, much as I like the idea of having my cake and eating it, we're probably going to have to wrap up because, Mark, appropriately enough, you're about to have to jump on a train, which is highly environmentally commendable.
Oh, yeah.
I hope that you're not stuck in a carriage with people FaceTiming noisily or munching smelly food, various other comestible offences.
I'm hoping on a 10:30 train on a Thursday morning that I won't have too many people eating breakfast or lunch, and I'll wing my way into London.
I don't put it past people. Anyway, well, thank you very much, guys. You've been marvellous as always. Now, next month is our British Grand Prix preview special, and I'm told that tickets are still available, so check them out, silverstone.co.uk. If you're based in England, okay, if you're abroad, come and sample our lovely weather. I'm sure it'll be great. If you don't yet subscribe to GP Racing, head to gpracing.com. Print and digital and Autosport Plus packages, you get all three these days, start at three issues for £3. If you prefer to enter an actual retail establishment, make sure your journey isn't wasted. Visit seymour.co.uk, type your postcode into the store finder to locate your nearest stockist. That's Seymour, spelled as in Seymour Airport, which serves the island of Baltra in the Galapagos. Thank you very much. We'll see you next month. This has been a Motorsport Network production. The producer was Dre Harrison.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. Funny thing about being fast, you end up waiting a lot. First to show up, first in line, then just waiting. Me, I rev up Chumba Casino. With over 200 social casino games, no slow lanes here. Why sit around when you can spin? I'm already racing. Your turn. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. That's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.